You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 28th of November to the 4th of December 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Jack Grove and deputy news editor John Morgan. The expansion of student numbers at private colleges is fueling a multi-million pound income stream for education company Pearson while spelling potential cuts for universities. That's our lead news story this week, about which we'll hear a little bit more later. Is snobbery among universities stopping students from poorer backgrounds from gaining degrees using credits accumulated from other institutions? It is, according to one leading educationalist. Jack will have a bit more about that later. And third story on our bill today, what does this piece of music have to do with a new computer network that was launched earlier this week? Be revealed later on. But first, John, the lead news story this week. It's all about private colleges. It's about student loan company funding. What's the story?
So the context for this is the overspend on students studying at private providers. And this is an overspend at the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills. And the suggestion is that this overspend has contributed to the need for BIS to find emergency savings elsewhere in its budget, and the private provider overspend might be part of what causes universities to suffer a further cut in their research budgets and the grants for poorer students. And another key element in the private provider situation is there are, as yet, no caps on student numbers, which there are at universities, of course. But the government is nevertheless keen to expand private provision to try and create more of a market. So it's giving more courses at private providers designation, which gives the students eligibility to claim funding from the student loans company. Mm-hmm. And so what we found is that this expansion is benefiting Pearson, which is a FTSE 100 company, and it's benefiting it through the higher national certificates and higher national diplomas for which Pearson is the main awarding body. So the more students on these courses, the more money students, the more money Pearson gets. And what we found is that of 226 new course designations at private providers between December 2012 and August 2013, 51 were for HNDs and HNCs. So it would look like Pearson may be taking up to a quarter of the new courses that get designated at private providers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there any way of tracking what happens to these courses once they're launched? So the course is launched, Pearson's the awarding body. How many students are taking them? How many are completing them? How much money is being handed out to those students from the public purse, as it were, via the loans company?
Well, the suggestion is that there are now 40,000 students on HNCs and HNDs, which is, you know, two or three decent sized universities. And David Willetts, the Universities and Science Minister, had to make a written ministerial statement on the private providers' situation, given the budget pressures that have been exposed. And he did admit that, you know, the growth was particularly concentrated among HNC and HND students. There have been big increases in the number of Bulgarians and Romanians applying for student support. And there may be some questions over whether there are students being funded but not actually turning up for the courses. I think that would be an area to watch.
And of course, these colleges don't have to go through the same checks as universities through the QAA. I mean, they are inspected, but I don't think it's quite as rigorous. It's a different inspection regime, so there's an issue of standards there.
Yeah, there's no requirement for private colleges to go through any kind of QAA review if they want the students to have public funding, even. Although, you know, some colleges do go through a QAA process voluntarily, but some will be completely under the radar in quality terms. So you're right, that's another area of concern.
Mm-hmm. And there could be, I understand, further pressure on Biz today, in fact, if you're listening to this on the Thursday we come out. There's a National Audit Office report due.
That's right. This is also something that could, well, will add to the pressure on Biz, particularly around the budget issue. The National Audit Office has carried out a report into the student loan system, and it's found that Biz needs to up its game on collection of student loans when graduates repay them, and also on the forecasting that Biz does in terms of the RAB charge, the portion of the loans that will never be repaid. National Audit Office has been, you know, quite strongly critical of Biz on the RAB charge and on the collection issues. So I think there's real concerns around what's happening in the Biz budget at the moment, and there's probably a bit of pressure on David Willetts and Vince Cable.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll read that story on page 6 and 7 in the magazine. The National Audit Office report will be covered online at timeshighereducation.co.uk. I'm sure we may have some of it in the magazine as well next week. But in this week's magazine, Jack, you've been speaking to a prominent educationalist about credit transfer. Who is it? What have they said?
Well, this is a very eminent person in the sector, Sir David Watson. He was a former vice-chancellor, and he was a member of the Deering Report Committee back in 1997, and he's now at the University of Oxford, where he's Professor of Higher Education. And he's talking about credit transfer, and he calls this the most serious single piece of unfinished business in UK higher education.
Strong words.
And what basically the issue is that in the UK, if you go to university, you've got to really start in the first year, no matter if you've maybe done 1 or 2 years somewhere else and dropped out. Generally, you have to start from scratch. And this is very unlike the US, where people are transferring all the time between different institutions. They're sort of dropping out, dropping in.
Or do a community college qualification and transfer to another institution, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, this is something that David Watson says is a real problem, because universities are quite precious about the students they admit. They want their own students, they want them to come through a very set route. We're applying to them from UCAS, often, you know, as 18-year-olds, and they don't want students transferring between different universities. But David Watson is saying that unless you have this, you're excluding quite a lot of people from the system, because some people might say they want to do, say, a half-year course in a certain subject, and that might sort of ignite their enthusiasm for a subject, and then they might sort of use those credits and go on and do a full honours degree and then a master's and then a PhD. But as it is, you can't really accumulate credits and take them with you from one institution to the other. So in it, you're sort of excluding lots of people. In fact, the only people you're including in the undergraduate system is those who are going to commit to a full-time, well, full or part-time course over three years, do a full honours degree and see it all the way through to the end. So he's saying this is a really key thing, and we need to look at the US system, where they've really embraced this idea of credit transfer and are accepting students at different stages in their development.
Isn't there a problem that there's a lot of variability in standards between different universities, different courses? So if you studied at one university, you might be doing less work, putting in less hours to work towards your degree than another university. So why should you be able to, you know, step up to a sort of perceived better university if you've been doing less work?
Well, this would be in the framework. The effective framework that needs setting up. But David Watson would say that universities need to have a bit more mutual respect. I mean, the whole sector is founded on this idea of mutual confirmation of standards. So when we say that one university is a good university, those standards are confirmed by other people in the sector. And so we need to sort of take that idea of mutual respect and sort of push it through a little bit further. And it doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to be sort of transferring from Oxford Brookes to Oxford or from Anglia Ruskin to Cambridge. And but then he's saying, I think you need to have a bit more of a recognition of some of the work and the experience and the credits that people have built up, and have a more flexible curriculum to enable them to sort of gradually work their way towards a degree rather than expecting everyone to do it all in just one go.
Now that's on page 8 this week and well worth a read. And another story of yours, Jack, we should touch very quickly on actually. The latest on the industrial dispute over pay. There's a strike planned for Wednesday next week, of course. But
Tuesday,
I beg your pardon. But a legal expert has warned you that universities could withhold pay from some of their staff who just work to rule rather than perhaps necessarily going out on strike entirely.
Yes, well, all the university staff who are walking out on Tuesday will expect to have their pay withheld for not turning up to work and joining the picket line, and they're fine with that. But at the same time, you've also got this work to contract that is taking place. It started on the 1st of November, and university staff are being advised by, well, union members are being advised by UCU that they should only work to the set hours of their contract.
Mm-hmm.
And when an individual's hours are not set, there's just an expectation that they do the job that they've always been doing. It becomes a little bit more tricky. So people should dig out their contract and see what they are expected to do, first of all. But when hours are not clearly defined, you should look at sort of workload agreements by department, see what is expected of you there. And if there is no workload agreement, then the working time regulation, which says that people shouldn't be working longer than 48 hours, is something that the UCU are using as a guide to their staff. But the legal expert I've been speaking to has been saying that it's not as restrictive as the UCU are making out, partly because it's done over a 17-week average,
mm-hmm.
which means you just can't down tools in any one week once you reach your set amount of hours. It's quite involved, but there are some interesting things, and universities have quite a lot of power to direct their staff on what they want prioritised. So they could say we want marking done first, teaching how to done first, and everything else has to take a bit of a back seat. We want these key things to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But the legal expert who advises a lot of universities saying that universities are unlikely to be docking pay unless some serious disruptions occur. Mm. It'd be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, well, theoretically, the fact that it's possible, I suppose, will concern a lot of our readers, and also just highlights that fact, make sure you know what's in your contract. And I suppose universities should also make sure they know from an administration side what it is they can and can't do as this dispute continues. We played a bit of music at the very beginning of the show. We'll go back to that in a second. Before that, I should just flag up this week's cover feature, which is by Phil Clark, reader in Comparative and International Politics at SOAS University of London. This week he's asking whether academics researching authoritarian regimes on the ground should self-censor in order to gain the access they need. A tricky issue and a captivating piece. But yes, that music. I was at the launch this week of Janet 6, which is the new computer network for the UK HE and FE sector. There's lots of techie details in the magazine this week about it. Essentially, it comes down to the fact that research these days needs to send a lot more data between institutions in order to run smoothly. We covered a report recently that shows that more than half of European research papers involve inter-institutional collaboration. So people are sending data all over the place, particularly those in sort of data-hungry disciplines like climate science and biomedical sciences, things like that. And it can be quite tricky to sort of get excited about these large infrastructure projects. They're essentially a means to an end. They're necessary so the exciting stuff can happen. But what happened at the launch event I went to earlier this week, to demonstrate the speed this network is capable of, they set up a trio of musicians, a violinist, a cellist and a guitarist. The twist being that the violinist was located at Edinburgh Napier University, while the guitar player and the I beg your pardon, the cellist was in Edinburgh, the violin player and the guitar player were in London, and they performed the following song using the technology that is now connecting the UK's universities to each other. So if you can pick up any delays or any slight pauses from the musicians, you're a better person than me, because it was a thoroughly successful demonstration of how fast it is. So that's the end of this week's Times Higher Education issue review, and playing us out are Sean Matthews, Sue Lee and Cassandra Matthews, who weren't even in the same room as each other when they played.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.